Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Aloha and namaste, everyone. It is 4 p.m. here in New York City. I'm John Heilman in for Nicole Wallace. That's the bad news. The good news, she'll be joining us in the next hour as we assess and analyze the monster news from last night that the FBI yesterday searched Mar-a-Lago, the private club and Palm Beach residence of the disgraced, twice impeached, coup-attempting former president of the United States, Donald J. Trump. It is no exaggeration to say three things about this move by the Justice Department. One, it's wholly without precedent in American history. Two, that it's ignited a political firestorm. And three, it has sent the country hurtling into uncharted territory. The search yesterday, which reportedly involved federal agents spending most of the day at Mar-a-Lago, was related to classified information that Trump took with him when he departed the White House in January of 2021. An attorney for the former guy told NBC News that Trump and his team have been, quote, cooperative with FBI and DOJ officials every step of the way, unquote, but then added that the Bureau, quote, did conduct an unannounced raid and seized paper. The New York Times reports that it wasn't the first time that agents visited Trump's South Florida estate. Quote, the search came after an earlier visit this spring to Mar-a-Lago by federal agents, including a Justice Department counterintelligence official, to discuss materials that Mr. Trump had improperly taken with him when he left the White House. Mr. Trump was briefly present for that earlier visit, as was at least one of his lawyers, according to people familiar with the situation. Both the FBI and the Justice Department have declined to comment. It was Trump himself who first notified the world of this Mar-a-Lago search, claiming that the raid was politically motivated. Trump's news flash came in the form of a typically lengthy, inaccurate, crazily punctuated, and BS-riddled statement, which, therefore, we will not be reading, with the sole exceptions of one delicious exclamation, quote, they even broke into my safe, and one statement that, in a rarity for Donald Trump, was unequivocally true, quote, nothing like this has ever happened to a president of the United States before. But the very fact that a search warrant was issued and a raid was conducted can tell us a great deal about the state of the investigation into Donald Trump's handling of classified material, a probe that reportedly began earlier this year when the National Archives asked the DOJ to investigate how classified information, some of it so sensitive that the information can't even be described, ended up at Donald Trump's South Florida club. As the New York Times puts it, quote, the FBI would have needed to convince a judge that it had probable cause that a crime had been committed and that agents might find evidence at Mar-a-Lago in order to get a search warrant. Proceeding with a search on a former president's home would almost surely have required sign-off from top officials at the Bureau and the Justice Department. And that is where we kick off today. Joining us now, Betsy Woodruff Swan, national correspondent for Politico, as well as an MSNBC contributor. My friend Jonathan Lemire, he is here, Politico's White House bureau chief, host of MSNBC's Way Too Early, and the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Big Lie, plus MSNBC legal analyst Andrew Weissman. He's a former DOJ prosecutor, senior member of Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation, and Asha Rangappa, former FBI special agent for counterintelligence, now a senior lecturer and a former assistant dean at Yale. Guys, I welcome to the day. It's a big day, and we've got a lot to talk about. Betsy, I just want to start with you to kind of give me a sense of everybody in the world watched what happened yesterday, and now we are not quite 24 hours later. What, just give us the big overview of where we are at this moment with this story, as opposed to where we were last night when we first learned the news.
What we've had is basically more details get filled in to add context and color to the basic fact that emerged last night in rather shocking fashion. I can confirm that Justice Department officials visited Mar-a-Lago several months ago, that Trump himself interacted with them at least in a small way when they made that visit, that at least one of his lawyers was there. And after that meeting happened, Trump's legal team and people close to him have signaled that they thought they were giving DOJ what DOJ wanted. Obviously, that wasn't the takeaway that the Justice Department had after that conversation. And to get a search warrant like this, the FBI has to persuade a judge that there's evidence at a particular location, at a particular moment in time, that would be directly related to a crime being committed. So that means their concerns about potential criminal activity, of which there could be evidence at Mar-a-Lago, persisted for months after that meeting, despite the fact that people in Trump's orbit have signaled that the tenor of that meeting was not particularly hostile or acrimonious. Trump himself, in his statement, said that he thought this raid, or quote unquote raid, was totally unnecessary and uncalled for. The Trump people have been signaling that they think in their view, or they argue in their view, that they've been cooperating, but that clearly is extremely far afield from the views at FBI and DOJ.
Andrew Weissman, I ask you this question. You know, the definition of cooperation would presumably have allowed this whole thing to be worked out over the course of these months that Betsy's just talking about. We're going to look at the timeline in a second. But I mean, in your experience, when people go to get warrants of this kind from a judge, is it not the case in general that no judge wants to give a warrant if there's some other way for it to be worked out through a cooperative negotiation with the parties? This seems like the judge here, especially in the case of a former president, would have needed to be convinced that, like, the time for talk was over. No?
Yes and no. First, the judge would not get involved in that decision, the one about whether this could get worked out or not. The judge's sole role is for him or her to decide whether there's probable cause of a crime and probable cause that the evidence of that crime would be in that location. But there's no question that what you're saying is true with respect to the Department of Justice, because normally the way that you get information is either through a voluntary request or through a subpoena. And when you proceed by search warrant, what you're really saying is, I don't trust the person who I could subpoena to actually comply with that subpoena. And I think the missing piece for all of this is that Merrick Garland had to have asked the question, why do we need to proceed by search warrant and not by subpoena? And there had to have been a pretty compelling answer that they thought that the former president would not comply with the subpoena. And I think that's the piece that we're missing, is that evidence that led them to think that there would be essentially a form of obstruction of justice unless they went in by search warrant.
Andrew, this is a very serious time for our country, but I just need to know whether that was a dog or a goat that just walked behind you on camera.
Yeah, so that's my English Cocker Spaniel, who okay. has a habit of coming on air just as the cameras roll.
I would just say that he or she is always welcome here. I just want to make sure it wasn't a goat. That was going to be a different question. Jonathan Lemire, I want to throw up the timeline I mentioned a second ago. Here's the kind of the what we know about Trump's handling of the classified information. You got in mid-January of 2022, the National Archives retrieves 15 boxes of documents from Mar-a-Lago. We'll remember the stories about all of this. In February, the Archives asks the DOJ to investigate. In early May, the DOJ subpoenas the National Archives for classified material. In the spring, around that same time, agents visit Mar-a-Lago. We know that now from the New York Times. Trump is present at that meeting. And now we have the FBI doing this search of Mar-a-Lago. I from the perspective of someone who knows Trump world really well and has reported on them throughout all of this, did you have any sense from any of your sources anywhere in the former president's orbit that this was a thing that people were bracing for? Was there, I mean, that's a very leaky place. People generally talk about a lot of stuff. Stuff doesn't stay secret for very long. It's surprising to me that Trump kind of apparently saw this coming, or at least thought that he was still very much entangled in this investigation, and that we read nothing about it during the last couple of months.
Well, first of all, John, no wildlife here, no goats at all. But there are people in Trump orbit that I have spoken to. They knew, of course, there were some degrees of contact here. The agents had visited a few months prior. They were surprised that it came to this step. They thought that they'd be able to resolve this through normal course of negotiation. They did think they were being cooperative. They didn't anticipate the agents to suddenly show up in Palm Beach yesterday, you know, talking to Secret Service allowing them on the property. Of course, we should note the former president was not there. He was in New York City yesterday. But this is something that they have been concerned about. Of course, there's a whole slew of legal issues swirling around the former president right now. It can be in New York, it can be in Georgia, it can be in D.C., and now this. And of course, the January 6th committee's work continues apace, the Department of Justice working there as well. Now, obviously, this is Donald Trump, so politics come quickly at hand. And he has been hinting at for a while that he thought he suggested he might be a martyr, a victim of the deep state. If there's one truism to the Trump presidency, is that every day was fueled by grievance and a sense of victimhood. And that's happening again with the statement last night from what we're hearing, the echoes from his allies, Republicans in Washington and around the country yesterday and again today, suggesting that he was being unfairly singled out, that he was a victim of a conspiracy, and that this was a politically motivated search. Now, the White House has made clear, I broke the news last night, that they got no heads up whatsoever about this raid. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre just now, moments ago in the briefing room, reiterated that as well, saying even the president himself found out about it from watching television. So they are saying they're keeping their distance from this, but certainly former President Trump and his team are going to try to play the victim card as much as they can going forward to try and swirl up the hornet's nest.
Asha, I want to ask you, about a tweet that Andrew Weissman sent last night, where he noted that that Trump apparently made the decision that it was in his interest to publicize this investigation. The DOJ sort of played it by the book and were keeping it quiet. What do you think it is? I know this would be speculative, but what do you think it would have led Trump to determine that it was in his interest to try to publicize that this had happened and do it the way he did?
Well, Don, Trump is an information warrior. I mean, he's very savvy with information warfare, and he understands that getting his narrative out actually, helps rally the people around him. And so I think we just need to distinguish between the court of public opinion and the court of law. And from a legal perspective, what I would say is to also approach the search from a national security angle. If he was in possession of classified documents, those are by definition potentially harmful to our national security if they result in any kind of disclosure or leak or somebody gets their hands on them. So it's an ongoing national security threat. And in terms of the negotiation, it's, they've gone above and beyond in terms of trying to get these back. I mean, if I steal something, I'm really not in a position to negotiate keeping them. They shouldn't have been there. But I think at this point, they have no choice but to go retrieve them if he continues to hang on to them because of the threat that they pose. And just, what kind of secrets could these be? This could be defense information. It could be about our weapon systems or technology, the kinds of things that a president might have access to, names of agents who are abroad undercover. I mean, these are very serious things. And, any normal employee wouldn't be able to even go into a skiff with a cell phone because that's how sensitive these are. And apparently he had these in a room at Mar-a-Lago that wasn't even locked, and they had to ask him to put a padlock on it. So I think that we do need to emphasize how serious this is from the government's perspective.
There's a phrase about a piece of information from some old television show. It might have been Seinfeld, where people talk about things being in the vault. There's, when it comes to Donald Trump, there's nothing in the vault. And that's why reason for concern when you're talking about classified information. The New York Times talks a little bit about the context for this. A Mike Schmidt piece that I want to read here and then talk to a couple of you about on the other side. He said in this piece, when a search warrant might be issued on a senior government official, it says it's unusual for senior government officials to be charged in connection with mishandling classified information. There have been some high profile exceptions, like General David H. Petraeus and President Clinton's National Security Advisor Sandy Berger. But in most instances, when the Justice Department or the FBI learns the classified information is being kept in an unsecure way, it conducts what's known as a spill investigation to determine where the materials are. As part of that investigation, FBI agents determine whether any sensitive national security information has been revealed so the intelligence community can take countermeasures to protect sources and methods. Betsy, is your sense on the basis of what you know in your reporting in this period that this is a spill investigation, or is this distinctly not a spill investigation?
I wouldn't be able to speculate about whether this fits into one or the other categories, but there's no question that it's not necessarily a binary, and that even if the Justice Department, one would certainly assume and hope, is trying to figure out the extent to which potentially mishandled classified information could have been inadvertently or deliberately shared with people who shouldn't have been able to see it, that wouldn't preclude DOJ from simultaneously looking at the possibility of lawbreaking in association with the way that classified material was handling. It could be one, It could be the other. It could also be all of the above. What we've also seen reported in multiple places today is that this particular investigation is not part of the January 6th probe. Rather, it's a separate undertaking. Just in terms of the way that this particular project works, we simply have less visibility because it's smaller and it's more narrowly tailored, at least based on what's publicly known, than the investigation that Thomas Wyndham is leading out of DOJ, which has been asking questions about the former president and bringing some of his former senior White House officials in front of a grand jury for testimony.
So, Andrew, I just read that piece and the two citations in there, the Petraeus example and the Sandy Berger example. I remember both those cases and I remember both those stories. I couldn't tell you right now why it was that they got charged when most people don't in these cases. Can you give any kind of insight into that? What the distinction is in those cases, why they got charged, and whether that has any bearing on how we should think about what might happen to Trump?
Well, it's hard to know how it will play out in terms of Trump. I was actually in the department at the FBI for the Petraeus investigation, and that did involve search warrants. It did involve speaking to General Petraeus and his denying having given classified information to a person he was having a relationship with, who was also writing a book about him, which turned out to be false. And he ended up pleading to a misdemeanor. I think there probably are people in the department and outside of the department, including myself, who thought that was a fairly light resolution, given the nature of the classified information that had been intentionally given by him. I think it's too early to say whether that will be a precedent that Merrick Garland looks to, because we don't know the nature of the classified information here, and the volume of information, and also the intentionality. But the one thing that I think we really have to keep our eye on is, in order to do this kind of search, I do think that the government has information that they were essentially lied to, and that they were told that their information had been provided and returned when it wasn't. Right. So I do find that it's going to be a potentially aggravating factor if and when the department gets to the decision of whether there should be charges here.
Right. So Andrew actually tweeted last night in a very kind of clear, concise way. He said, what's next? Presumably Trump told the DOJ he returned everything classified and the search may well reveal that he did not. Like Petraeus, he would be subject to false statement, criminal charge, and theft of government property and other similar crimes. So let's talk about the law here. And Lamira, I want to ask you something come out of this. Here's the law in question. U.S. Code Chapter 101, Records and Reports, Section 2071, Concealment, Removal, or Mutilation Generally. Subpoint B. Whoever having the custody of any such record, proceeding, map, book, document, paper, or other thing, willfully and unlawfully conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, falsifies, or destroys the same, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for not more than 3 years or both. And here comes the important sentence. And shall forfeit his office and be disqualified from holding any office under the United States. Is this, John Lemire, we talked a lot over the course of the last 24 hours that of all the things Trump is facing, this is the charge, the criminal liability that we, had most downgraded. We weren't really focused on this. We're looking at January 2nd and insurrection and all the other stuff. But if you're a Republican or a Trumpista, don't you get a little chill down your spine when you read that last sentence, that last part of the sentence there? If he gets hit with that charge, can't run again.
Yeah, that might be the most terrifying part of all. That's why he was so obsessed, flashing back here, with his second impeachment trial. He, of course, was already out of office at that point, but a conviction would have meant he couldn't run again. And that's why he was so nervous throughout that and so relieved that he was acquitted by the Republicans in the Senate. And he faces that here now as well. Now, there's some questions as to whether that would apply. We did some litigation about this, remember, during the Hillary Clinton email matter back in 2015, 2016, and there was a sense that it potentially wouldn't apply. Also, some legal scholars who know more about this than I do have been quoted today saying it's a gray area and that really this is a power about precluding a president from someone from running for president again that's in the Constitution, not an act of Congress. So I think if this were to be applied, we'd have a lot of legal battles over it. But certainly you've hit on a key point here. And that's what the Trump people think is happening, is that they believe their public messaging here is that he's being targeted because the Democrats don't want in the deep state, don't want him to run again. Now, of course, that's not what's happening. That would be perhaps a pleasant byproduct for some on the left. But there, this is Department of Justice has made clear, and they've said it time and again, that no one is above the law, that this isn't politically motivated. And that whether you're a former president or a potential presidential candidate, if you break the law, you will pay for it. And that's where the last point here, that speculation is really picking up. There have already been rumors that Trump wasn't going to wait until 2023, the traditional mark of a new presidential campaign, that he wants to do it this year. He wants to jump out ahead of the midterms, which very few Republicans think is a good idea. He's being urged by many in his inner circle to declare as soon as possible, even in the next coming days, as an attempt to get ahead of this story.
Jonathan Lemire, I know you and I, we both pine for the day when it was a consensus view of people and good people of goodwill in both parties that someone who was actually convicted of mishandling classified information, that person probably shouldn't run for president again, definitely should never be president again. We wouldn't even have a fight about it, but those days are long gone. Anyway, Lemire, thank you for starting us off. Everyone else is sticking around. When we come back, a deep, albeit speculative, dive into the mind of Attorney General Merrick Garland, man who has been so cautious and so methodical in doing his job that you can't help but wonder what he was thinking when he approved the search of Mar-a-Lago and what that portends on other fronts of the department's investigations into Donald Trump. Plus, Trump's allies have spent all day today ignoring what this search was really all about, the mishandling of classified documents. But this is the same gang who, 6 years ago, wanted Hillary Clinton tossed in jail for exactly the same offense. The Republican hypocrisy hitting new wuthering heights. And later in the show, Nicole Wallace, the actual host of the show, comes back on, joins us. She'll be here. You want to stick around to hear that, see that. Deadline White House continues after this. Don't go anywhere.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
No person is above the law in this country. I can't say it any more clearly than that. There is nothing in the principles of prosecution, in any other factors, which prevent us from investigating anyone, who's criminally responsible for an attempt to undo a democratic election.
That was the typically tight-lipped, stoic, circumspect, bone-dry Attorney General Merrick Garland back in July of 2020 when asked by reporters about the DOJ investigating the former guy. We're back with our panel. I want to start with you and just ask, I'm going to ask you and Andrew basically the same question just to start this off, which is, tell me, give me your sense of Merrick Garland. This is kind of a baseline question, right? Because the larger frame for all of this is not just what this investigation portends, what this investigation is about itself, but what it might portend around on other fronts. And everyone in the legal world and everyone in politics speculates about what Merrick Garland is thinking, how he views Donald Trump, how he views this job. So let's start with you. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that there are two sides to this. So on the one hand, we have an answer to the question of whether he is willing to investigate Donald Trump. He clearly is because he's taken this step. I think the other side is he is willing to investigate Donald Trump I think, quite reluctantly. If we look at the January 6th investigation, by all indications, he has sort of dragged his feet to get to a point where he is really starting to look at his role and complicity in the events that transpired that day, which kind of brings me to the bigger picture here, is that I really don't think anyone in their right mind would want to go after this unless it was absolutely necessary. I mean, we have seen this movie before. They are going to comb through this entire case from beginning to end, you know, look to see for any kind of missteps. And everyone knows from the agent on the ground up to Merrick Garland that they are going to be in the crosshairs. So I think it gets to the importance and the urgency of this particular investigation. What is at stake, that they felt that this was absolutely necessary to go into a former president's home to take these documents before they caused any more harm.
Andrew, when you worked very closely in this world, and it's obvious that Merrick Garland is saying the things that you would want him to say, saying the things that he has to say. Well, I have two part question. One, do you have any doubt that this warrant question went all the way up to him and that he had to approve it? Number one. And number two, the same question I just asked Asha, which is like, what's your general take on Garland and his appetite for bringing charges on any front against Donald Trump?
First question, I think it is highly likely that the Attorney General approved this and got a recommendation from the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, and agreed with it. I am in violent agreement with Asha. I think that there certainly is criticism that could be brought to bear with respect to the department investigating beyond the January 6th rioters and the history and whether they really did this with alacrity. Having said that, I do think at this point, Merrick Garland is showing that he has the backbone that is necessary to do this investigation. And it's going to require not just competence, which he will have to display, but real backbone to be a leader for his team and to weather the kinds of criticisms that will make the criticisms of Robert Mueller pale in comparison. But I do think he is up for the job.
Betsy, you know, one thing that's been true of Merrick Garland from the very beginning was he's been I don't want to say obsessed, but he's been very focused on the notion of trying to repair the damage that the Justice Department suffered in the Trump era. The view that it was no longer an independent in the way the Justice Department normally is, even though it isn't a political appointee who runs it. And he's been trying to kind of fix that, try to make sure that its reputation for independence get restored. Knowing what kind of a political firestorm this was going to set off, it must have taken a fair amount to get him to take this step. Is that not kind of the obvious conclusion here, that this is the thing where, man, it must be serious if Merrick Garland is going to court this kind of controversy?
That certainly seems to be the safest bet, with the only addition that sometimes the FBI makes mistakes, sometimes the Justice Department makes mistakes, sometimes these powerful institutions take steps that don't result in the outcomes that many observers are hoping to see. The fact that this has happened does not guarantee that Trump could be charged, does not guarantee that a jury would convict him. It doesn't bake in anything. But given what we know about Garland, it would, without question, be pretty stunning if he took the step of greenlighting such a politically electric move without having total confidence that the FBI had the goods, without having total confidence that whatever they were looking for yesterday at Mar-a-Lago was, in fact, going to be there. And remember, Garland is sometimes a little prickly even about the independence of the Justice Department. Only in the last few months or so, there was a DOJ statement that went out essentially pushing back against a comment that President Biden made offhandedly, where he suggested that the DOJ needed to be doing more to look at Trump. It was a rare, understated, but significant reprimand of the commander-in-chief from DOJ, essentially saying, this is up to us. We're going to do what we want to do. Please, no commentary from the peanut gallery, even if members of the peanut gallery are also leading the free world right now.
I mean, it's you know, Jonathan Lemire, who is just here, has reported, and I believe it to be true, that there has been a lot of frustration in the Biden White House over over what it has seen as the pace of the investigation, what it has been able to glean about what Merrick Garland has been doing. So they are, like everybody else in Washington and elsewhere, looking at what Garland's kind of those gnomic kind of careful statements about how he will, you know, he'll prosecute anybody who's violated the law in the January 6th investigation. They look at them and they read the Rorschach just like everyone else does. And Aisha, it is... That is the Rorschach, right? Some people hear that and say, this guy is trying to tell us in the best way he can that he will do whatever is necessary, politics be damned. Other people say, well, man, that sounds like a guy who's making excuses for himself, laying down a predicate for not prosecuting. It feels to me like if he was willing to go to court this controversy over again, the least of the charge, not to diminish the importance of mishandling classified material, but the least explosive of the charges, he's willing to court this kind of explosiveness. He is, I think, sending a pretty unmistakable signal, whether he means to or not, that like, I really mean it. I don't care what the political consequences are. I have the backbone, as Andrew put it, to do whatever the law requires and go wherever the facts lead. And I just can't help but think that a lot of people are going to read it that way.
Yeah. You know, I really think that it's important to keep this separate from January 6th. Like I said, I think that there's a certain straightforwardness to this in terms of being able to justify these measures because of the national security risk. I think it would be hard, depending, you know, if we ever get any indication of what's contained in these documents. Apparently, they're so sensitive, they can't be described. I think that, you know, it's easier to justify having to take extraordinary measures when the stakes are that high. And, you know, there are statutes that are quite straightforward in terms of, you know, unauthorized possession, a willful failure to return them that you may be able to apply. January 6th gets into very, very complicated, you know, conspiracies. What did he know? What did he really believe? And, you know, it may raise actually other types of defenses that may not be applicable here that Garland may not want to litigate and may not want to, you know, take all the way up to the Supreme Court. So I don't know that one necessarily means something for the other. I do think that, as Andrew mentioned before, and I echo this as well, that he clearly is willing to do it when he believes that he has a case to be made. And I think that's the most important thing at this point.
Andrew, I want to close with one question to you. And I feel I've seen you on TV a few times in the last 18 hours. And this may be a question that you've kind of already answered, but I want to draw it out because I think it's super important. The Trump people basically say this is a politically motivated hit job. There's no legal basis for this. This is harassment. We're taking the power of the state and applying it and trying to shoot him down for trying to keep him from running for president in 2024, et cetera, et cetera. I believe that either you or Neil Katyal or some combination of the two of you may have made a point about, hey, Trump people, if you really believe that this warrant is defective, there are a few things you could do. And one of them would be go challenge it in court. And the other would be make it public. Talk a little bit about why that is, I think, a necessary thing to kind of call BS on what they are saying publicly about this warrant. There's a lot of ways for them to resolve it. I don't see them doing any of them yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that the president decided to go public with it is because he must have decided that there is political hay that he could make out of this because he likes being the victim. And, you know, you're seeing that play out. And so, you know, this is one where it's so ironic that he's saying it's the department that was political when he is the one who is actually publicizing this and making a political point out of it. There are certain things that the president could do to challenge the warrant, but they're quite limited. So first, it's really important to remember that all that the president and his lawyers would see is the actual warrant and something called the warrant return. The warrant is just the document that says what the agents can search for, and it should give a sense of what the crimes are that the government is investigating. And the warrant return is simply a list of everything that was obtained. This is probably, Aisha probably knows this better than I do, because this is the kind of thing that agents have to fill out all the time. What Donald Trump does not have and is unlikely to get soon is the actual underlying affidavit from the FBI agent setting out the probable cause. That is something that typically would not be given over to someone unless and until they are charged. And then they have a right to it because they can move to suppress. But having said that, we've seen John Eastman, even without that kind of underlying affidavit make motions to try and suppress the warrant that was obtained for his phone. Now, those motions have not been successful, but there is a way to go to court to make those kinds of applications if they thought that this was defective legally. And the fact that they haven't, to me, is very similar to his many, many lawsuits that he brought to claim that the election was fraudulent, all of which he lost. So, you know, I think the fact that he's not going to court is because he might be afraid to get the answer from a court, which is that everything here was done by the book.
Yeah, I think he probably at this point is paying his own legal bills, too. And God knows the man does not want to go to court and waste money on a losing cause. Betsy Woodruff Swan, Andrew Weissman, and Aisha Rangappa, thank you guys all for spending some time with us. The party of law and order, huh? Basically saying the ex-president, he's above the law. Republicans coming to the defense of Donald Trump and vowing to investigate the FBI and worse. More on all of this after a quick break.
Radio Andy.
Hey, it's Andy Cohen. Join me on Andy Cohen Live, where it's just you, me, and some of the world's biggest celebrities.
Paris Hilton.
Chelsea Handler.
Seth Rogen.
I love you, Miley. Thank you so much.
You can listen to Andy Cohen Live at home or anywhere you are. No car required. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
I think she should be in jail for what she did with her emails. Okay? She should be in jail.
Hillary Clinton is disqualified from being the commander-in-chief.
For others, the consequences of misusing classified information have been swift and serious, but not for Hillary Clinton.
What I can tell you is this. Had you done it, or had I done it, I'd be off the Intelligence Committee. My classification would have been removed.
Instead of being held accountable, Hillary is running for president.
But the hypocrisy! Oh, my God. In the hours after the ex-president announced that the FBI's search of his Mar-a-Lago home, the butthurt emails, faithful returned, personally offended by the news of an unprecedented move taken against an unprecedentedly corrupt former president. It must be political. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy saying, I've seen enough, and vowing to conduct immediate oversight of the Justice Department if the Republicans win back control of the House, warning Attorney General Merrick Garland to, quote, preserve your documents and clear your calendar. Chair of the Republican National Committee calling the FBI raid of Mar-a-Lago a partisan attack, saying it's the Democrats who have flouted the law and abused power. Senator Ted Cruz, my favorite U.S. senator, calling it, quote, unprecedented, corrupt, and an abuse of power. But hey, back in 2016, that was Ted Cruz, too, tweeting, elected officials, no matter how high their position, should be held accountable for criminal conduct. The rule of law matters. Ted, sing it. Joining us now, two friends, both from The Bulwark, Charlie Sykes, the editor-at-large there, and Tim Miller, writer-at-large for the site. Tim, also the author of a new book, and I want to say it's just a new book, a great, fantastic new book that's also a New York Times bestseller, Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell, both MSNBC contributors. And Charlie, I got to start with you. You have seniority over Tim, at least as far as I know. It's just, you know, it's like, I mean, there's a lot of things that illustrate Republican hypocrisy, but I don't know that there's been a better kind of like scientific experiment of how hypocritical the Republican Party is and how totally free of commitment, conviction, and principle than what we have seen. If you go back and look at what they said in 2016 and what they're saying right now.
Well, that was then, and this is now. And we've seen this reversal on a lot of things, but you're right. It is so dramatically stark. And we could add to that, that the complaint about weaponizing law enforcement from a guy who used to lead chants of lock her up. Conservatives spent much of the last year, people on the right talking about jailing Dr. Fauci. You have candidates running for governor talking about jailing people who are involved in the election, and they are deeply, deeply offended now that there might be some accountability for Donald Trump. Look, and not to mention the fact that, remember what they said about defunding the police? Well, that was then. Now they are all into defunding the FBI. And that was like an overnight switch. But what's really extraordinary is this sort of projection that here you have a president who has shown a willingness to try to abuse the Department of Justice, to attack his political opponents. And now they're saying, look, they're coming after us, and this will give us the excuse to come after our political opponents. But what really struck me, and I have to admit, I was, and you know, I shouldn't have been taken by surprise, since I've read Tim's book about all of this. But the way the elected Republicans just completely lined up last night, basically accepting the notion that Donald Trump should be above the law, and so they are not into. I mean, think about this. I mean, the Republican Party is not just into backing Trump; they are into covering up Trump's crimes, obstructing any investigations into Donald Trump, intimidating prosecutors who might go after Donald Trump, and now pledging retaliation against anyone that investigates Donald Trump. So, yeah, this is a hell of a transformation of the party of law and order.
Yeah, Tim, Charlie just said that was then and this is now, which I mean, yes, that's absolutely right. The difference between then and now, deserves some scrutiny, and you're famous for doing it. I got to do this a little bit because I could do it all day. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, let's put up that November 3rd, 2016 tweet. I could do it all day, and I'm going to at least for a little bit here. Here it is. When you're attacking FBI agents because you're under criminal investigation, you're losing. Sarah Huckabee Sanders last night, if you're not yet appalled by the total abuse of power from Democrats in Washington, you're not paying attention. And here's McCarthy from 2016 on Hillary Clinton and this probe development. Today's decision once again demonstrates Secretary Clinton's fundamental lack of judgment, disregard for protecting our nation's secrets. And now, you know, he's doing the stuff he's now doing, where he's kind of going after Garland. Like I said, I could do this all day. I'm going to let you do it some of this day. I mean, it's just like, Charlie says he was taken aback. You're not surprised by this, are you?
No, I'm not surprised, but I think, look, John, I was on your podcast, I guess it was last weekend, and it was you that was saying that you were concerned that an increasing prosecution, might lead to a dangerous response, right, and kind of an overwhelming surge to Donald Trump's defense. And so I'm not surprised that had happened, but I think that worse than the hypocrisy, really, is the incitement that we're getting
right
from Republican elected officials. I mean, you didn't show my old friend Marco Rubio up there talking about how, this is a third world government now. This is Marxism. This is communism. Leading Republican conservative commentators, D'Souza, Stephen Crowder, people calling for war. There's a state rep in Florida, Sabatini, saying that basically that FBI agents should be arrested, essentially calling for nullification. The rhetoric that has been notched up to 11 on this by even the more mainstream Republicans without even knowing what was in the court-issued warrant, right? I mean, we don't even have the details yet, and these guys are all stoking Civil War-esque rhetoric. And so and it's not surprising that these cowardly Republicans who have submitted themselves to Trump at every step along the way did it again. I have to say it's a little noteworthy just how radical the rhetoric is, even from the McCarthys and Rubios of the world. And I think at a time where, they're making really the same mistakes that they were making in the lead up to January 6th, thinking that they can, there was no political harm or no harm to the body politic to just run cover for Donald Trump and his lies and criminality. And that's what they did between the election and January 6th, thinking they're going to be rid of him. And they're all doing the same exact thing again. And I'm concerned it's going to lead to a similarly dangerous outcome.
I want to talk more about this, and I will say, just to clarify one thing, Tim, when we talked about this on the podcast, my point was not that I thought that this should stop there from being prosecutions. I was not arguing against them. What I was just saying was that I was concerned and am concerned that if there are prosecutions of Donald Trump, that there will be a rallying around Donald Trump and that it could be very dangerous. And right. I think we're seeing some evidence of that right now. Charlie and Tim, staying with us, more on today's GOP, proving that they are not the party of pro-police or pro-freedom or pro-life or pro-anything other than be it putting Donald Trump above the law.
So if Donald Trump were to become a candidate for president again, that would not change your schedule or how you move forward or don't move forward?
Say again that we will hold accountable anyone who was criminally responsible for attempting to interfere with the transfer, legitimate, lawful transfer of power from one administration to the next.
Aloha and namaste, everyone. It's now 5 p.m. here in Gotham City. I'm John Heilman, in for Nicole Wallace, although she'll be with us very soon. Kind of think of this whole thing as a collision between an unstoppable force and an immovable object. On one end, Attorney General Merrick Garland, who you saw right there, and the Department of Justice, as you just heard right there, doggedly committed to upholding the rule of law no matter what, to holding accountable those who would undermine our democracy from the events on January 6th to a number of other apparent crimes, including, apparently, maybe, likely, the mishandling of classified documents. On the other, a twice impeached, disgraced, coup attempting, loud talking former president of the United States with a proven track record of being, and we're really generous, and we call it legally questionable activity. Something like what happened at Mar-a-Lago last night always seemed like a possibility, but don't let that detract from the truly historic nature of what we're now seeing play out right in front of us, something we might very well end up telling our descendants about. Never before in American history has the FBI searched the home of a former commander-in-chief. For that reason, the Department of Justice has a very high bar to clear. The burden will be on the government, not only to explain what it was looking for with this search, but why the search was required, why they couldn't get it some other way, either through cooperation or through a subpoena. Already, Republicans are circling the wagons around Trump, calling the search politically motivated, and worse, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has vowed already to investigate the FBI should the GOP retake control of the lower chamber in November. That general outcry from Republicans was more or less predictable, although the volume of it has been kind of intense, insane. Any action taken against Donald Trump was always going to ignite a political firestorm. We know that, but that is the point. DOJ leaders must also have known that, and they decided to go through with it anyway. There is still so much to learn, but whatever happens next, these really are actually uncharted waters. And in order to help navigate them, joining us now on the phone, the actual host of this actual program, Deadline White House, my friend, Nicole Wallace. Nicole, hi.
Hi, you are so good, and you are you're so good to be there. Thank you so much. You're the best person to be there.
It's always a pleasure to do it for you. I always feel very like I'm barely kind of, you know, holding it together, given the example of competence and focus that you set. I saw you last night when you dialed into Rachel's show, and I immediately just said, you know what? Like, there's no doubt that we got to get her on the show today to talk about this. So I heard what you had to say last night. It's a little less than 24 hours later, but I know you've had a chance to at least reflect on the big macro picture here. Where do we start in your mind in terms of like how we look at this and what the significance of it is today and what the significance might be tomorrow?
Well, so I think there's two buckets, and you cover it expertly, as did Rachel last night, that there's, you know, there's the, let's, should we start with the classified stuff? I mean, Trump was breaking the law, and because he has such a wide, you know, swath of authority to declassify things, let's just say, threatening national security when it came to classified material. The earliest point we knew he was doing that was when he had Sergey Lavrov in the Oval. And I think H.R. McMaster ran, didn't walk, to the driveway to brief the press about how when he shared classified stuff, he hadn't endangered national security or sources and methods. You know, within minutes of that meeting, it was the first time we really knew how much his own national security advisors worried when Trump was in possession of classified information. So the history of his mishandling classified material dates back to the earliest days of his presidency. And most of the way we know that he did that was from non-readouts of meetings with people like Vladimir Putin when he went into meetings. So the mishandling of classified information has gone on for so long. I have so many questions about what it, and this, you know, Chuck Rosenberg explained to me last night that it can't be something he did 18 months ago. You know, the search warrant went before a judge with some current concern, some recent criminal activity for which there is probable cause to justify yesterday's search. So, you know, I have a million questions about what it is and what he was doing with it that represented a threat to national security. Was he using it to figure out where to build a new tower? Was he selling it? Was Jared using it to raise $1 billion from foreign leader? I mean, what is it and what was he doing with it is sort of one bucket of burning questions I have today.
Yeah, I mean, just hold on to that for a second, because, you know, before we even get to the larger question, some of the things we were talking about the last hour about Merrick Garland and what this might kind of portend about the future, you're right to pause on this. I mean, it's obviously a very serious crime, potentially, if there's a crime involved. And even though it was not the main crime that a lot of us have been thinking about for the last set of weeks. But, you know, you do kind of ask, like, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about is, you know, there's a judge who had to approve this warrant. We now all think that this went up very high at the DOJ. And so Merrick Garland kind of had to sign off on it, you know, and everybody says, you know, the judge, you know, he's got to look at whether there's probable cause, a crime is being committed, et cetera, et cetera. But you and I live in the real world, right? There's no way in which everybody involved in this decision was not bringing to it just the standards, the scrupulous standards of the law. All of them understood at every stage of this that this thing was going to be a big, giant explosion in our politics. And I can't help but think that that didn't change some people, not change their calculus, but that it makes it more significant to know that everyone who made the decision, from the judge to Merrick Garland, if he ultimately personally ruled on this, anybody in the DOJ who suggested this, everybody at the FBI, all had that in their mind. And that just, to me, speaks to both the seriousness of the crime and to the larger potential implications of what this whole thing could mean.
Yeah, I think that's right. The other thing that I think is, you talk to DOJ and FBI formers, and they say this is decided narrowly on whatever the facts of this issue with classified documents is. Okay, and we live in a world where a federal judge also said Donald Trump and John Eastman likely committed felonies. You can't unknow all the questions about criminal conduct in the other crown jewel of our democracy, which is the transition of power, that it be peaceful, that the Electoral Count Act isn't something all of us, you know, Google and know what it is. I mean, both things can be true. He can be under criminal scrutiny, and the search yesterday could pertain to a very narrow question of what classified materials are in his possession and what the hell he's doing with them and why they had to take his safe as well. Okay. But it is also true that we have spent 18 months learning about, as a country, his role in a criminal conspiracy to overturn the government he ostensibly led on January 6th. 2021. So I think both things are true. And then we're not in the room, but I've been in those rooms. Frankly, when you're in a White House, you have nothing to do with criminal investigations at the highest levels. But no one that you've had on, you know, has suggested that Merrick Garland, Lisa Monaco wouldn't have been involved in greenlighting this decision to go in and search Mar-a-Lago.
So that leads to the big question, it seems to me. And I know you and I kind of had a mind meld about this, because as I thought about this when it broke last night, my first question was like, look, and again, no one wants to minimize the importance of the potential crime here of mishandling classified information. It could be a very serious thing. And we've read the law, what the law stipulates. If Donald Trump were convicted of it, he would not be able to run for president again. It's a big deal, in addition to the other potential consequences. But really what everyone right now in our political culture and around the country is wondering is, what happens now about January 6th? And that makes everybody very, very much and rightly focused on Merrick Garland, who has been Delphic, right, over the course of the last year. He's saying the things you expect him to say, but everyone's looking for a tell. Does this guy have, I'll say the way that someone would say it, you know, does this guy have the stones? Does this guy have the guts, the appetite for taking on a big fight that's going to be incredibly political, incredibly polarizing? And many Democrats are afraid he doesn't. And up until yesterday, many Democrats, they said, oh, no, this is a guy, if you listen to his words, he's telling you, and the only way he can, he's ready for this fight. I mean, he just only cares about the law. And if there's been a law broken, he'll go after Donald Trump, doesn't matter what. I felt like last night that I don't mean that Garland is trying to send the signal. And I also don't mean that I think Garland is telling us he's going to prosecute, indict Trump on the January 6th charges. But I think he is telling us that he doesn't care about the firestorm. He doesn't care about igniting, about what kind of political controversy he's going to unleash. If he's going to do it on this case, given what we've seen, it sort of, to me, indicates that this is a guy who is implicitly saying, I really am going to decide this on the law. If there's a case to be made against Donald Trump, I'm doing it.
Yeah. And I mean, look, I think Merrick Garland would rather give birth to a unicorn than investigate and prosecute Donald J. Trump. But I think that what we learned about Merrick Garland is that all of the, you know, Merrick Garland doesn't send signs. Merrick Garland isn't trying to tell us that he does or does not have the backbone to do anything. I think he cares about the sanctity of the department, and to the degree that there are questions about how the department comes down on the rule of law, that may be something that bothers him and weighs on him, and that may have inspired some of his more impassioned declarations about pursuing crimes around January 6th. But what we do know is that crimes were investigated around classified material mishandled by Donald Trump. I mean, we know what they are, right? The 15 boxes of stuff he took. Right. We know from the archives the kinds of things that are missing. And we know that whoever was working that case, maybe that came out of the National Security Division and not the Criminal Division, which appears to be running the January 6th division. When those people running that case made their request or said, we're going to go before a judge to get a search warrant, to search Mar-a-Lago, to get this classified material back, because it is this important. It is, you know, and we don't know what that sentence sounds like, right? It is this important because X. Merrick Garland said yes. So we know that when a case was ripe enough to make its way to Lisa Monaco and Merrick Garland and involved classified information, and by extension, it involved American national security, Merrick Garland said, I don't care where they are, go get them. So I think that what we learned, and again, I really don't think Merrick Garland is trying to send anyone a signal. No. Not Donald Trump, not you and not me. But what we do know is where there are crimes, Merrick Garland didn't draw a line around Mar-a-Lago and right. say, this is too precious, this is right. too sacred. He said, go get it.
Or that this will cause too much of a kerfuffle. And I, again, I really want to be clear. I don't think he's trying to send us signals, but I think that there are times, often the most powerful signals, the most powerful tells, certainly at a poker table, are ones that you're not trying to send. They're the things totally. that the careful eye sees the tell and says, now I know something about that guy. He didn't mean to tell me that, but I now know something about him. And here's Tim O'Brien. I'm going to read one thing to you and ask you like a couple more questions, then we'll let you get back to your vacation. Tim O'Brien wrote this piece. He says, Trump's search should be Garland's opening act. I want to read this to you, and then I'm going to ask you what you think about this. He says, Garland appears to be convinced that Trump and a collection of his advisors committed crimes. So that's no longer a debating point. What matters now is whether Garland has the resolve to place all of that damning evidence before a jury, and whether that jury can be convinced that Trump broke the law. Those are strategic issues Garland must consider, just as he must weigh the political consequences of taking Trump to court. In the end, though, Garland's primary responsibilities aren't gauging what kind of a jury pool he might encounter or how an indictment will ripple across the MAGA land. The American democratic experiment is at stake, and Garland's core duty is to charge Trump for the crimes he committed and then let the judicial process run its course. I agree with that. I know you agree with that. Sitting here today, are you more confident that Garland, that this is right and that Garland sees the world this way? Are you more confident than where you were yesterday? The same level of confidence? Or I don't think it'll be less confident. So it's one of the two.
I mean, look, I think that the Band-Aid's been ripped off and we can see the wound now. And I think what's more interesting there is that Garland has a better visibility into Trump's criminal exposure than we do. And we don't know if the people working the cases surrounding January 6th have gone as far as the people working the cases surrounding classified material. I'm guessing they probably have not. But what it says is, to me, is that for Garland and Monaco, and Monaco's probably more involved in the day-to-day of sort of visibility into these cases than Garland is. But he certainly is, to use a Bush word, a decider. And I think that what it tells us is that what he's going to have to defend in terms of the history of the Department of Justice in this country is that if classified information was serious enough to search Mar-a-Lago and to take from Mar-a-Lago Donald J. Trump's safe, isn't democracy and crimes committed against democracy just as sacred? I mean, I totally agree, having worked in the White House, about classified information. But I also think that crimes, and again, this is, as I'm saying it, it's how you saying this, John. We have a federal judge in California saying felonies were likely committed by Donald Trump and Donnison. So I think that what it says is when crimes have been committed, we now have a bar that we know national security crimes, crimes involving classified information, will be pursued even if they include searching Mar-a-Lago for Donald Trump's stuff. Now, I had an unexpected family emergency last week. I'm away this week, so I'm getting sort of peeks into the Republican lunacy and their asinine response. I am horrified. I had thought that someone like Stephen Ayer, an insurrectionist testifying about how he was duped, not just by Donald Trump, but by Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson and all these morons parroting things that they knew were lies. And we know those three knew where they were lies, or at least Ingraham and Sean, because we saw what they were texting the chief of staff. If they parrot lies about DOJ, which is pursuing an incredibly aggressive investigation into Hunter Biden, more aggressive than anything Bill Barr did, they will be peddling more lies, the kinds of lies that ruined Stephen Ayer's life. And I don't have any sympathy for Stephen Ayer, but I think it is instructive. And I think to watch the base call for protests or chaos or dissent or disrespect for the FBI is a new horror and a new low for the right, which is so far down on the low road, they can't see the sky anymore. And I think their reaction in the last 24 hours has been disgusting.
Well, I agree with you. And I guess I will just have a very quick question here for you. Well, you know, one of the things that we saw, what we've seen over the last months, right, has been that there has not been a civil war in the Republican Party, but there's been some fractures, right, between the Trump dead enders, right, in the party, and some who have kind of been like, we still like Donald Trump, but you know, he's got a lot of baggage. I'm talking about voters now. You know, he's got some baggage. We should, you know, maybe give him a gold watch and let him go on, and like, let's get somebody new in there. Thank you very much. Thank you for your service, sir. But I guess I wonder whether you think what we've seen in the last in these hours since Trump announced that this raid took place, or not the raid, I want to say that the search took place at Mar-a-Lago, the way they've rallied to him. Do you think that this is in a perverse way the kind of thing that, you know, those hairline fractures that might have split into something in your former party, something more significant, that maybe what this will do perversely is hurt Trump legally, but help him politically in some ways?
I hate political chess because voters play, what do you see, right? I mean, voters don't play 3D chess. They what they feel and what they're experiencing in their lives is how they vote. And so when Republicans or Democrats play 3D chess, I mean, I don't like messing in the Democratic, I don't like any of the manufacturing of our politics. But I will say this, if it does cause them to rally around Trump because his criminality is so concerning around national security that they had to go search his house for the documents in question, bring it on. I mean, if their guy is such a threat to U.S. national security that the FBI had to apply for a warrant and go search it, and they want him to be their standard bearer right at the point when they're about to flush the toilet of him, as we learn more and more about how he flushed documents down his own toilet, go ahead. Democrats should say, bring it on. And you know, the Democrats should say, you want to investigate why DOJ had to go search Mar-a-Lago for classified information? I'll make those bipartisan. We want to know too. I mean, I think that it's time for the Democrats to say, you want this guy, you can have him. And you want oversight over the government? That's a good idea. We have too many Americans who don't trust politicians and the government. We'll help you in that. But don't turn it into a circus. And I think that if anyone is aware of the kind of BS games that Republicans are playing, it is the very sort of slow-moving and methodical leaders of this Justice Department. Lisa Monaco, I think, may have had the most bipartisan confirmation out of any cabinet appointee that President Biden put up. So the idea that the Republicans are like, gotcha, with whatever went on behind closed doors that led to, you know, a judge being asked to approve a search warrant for Mar-a-Lago, I am certain, as you said at the end of the last hour, will be a headline that benefits the rule of law and not Donald Trump and the Republicans.
Nicole Wallace, they told me when they said I was coming in to fill in for you, they said you would be unreachable. You were so far away, you'd be like the Arctic Circle or something. You would never be, there was no way we could ever, like, doesn't matter whether I, No, I will never. She'll never come. You can never find her. She's in the seventh circle of whatever. And it turns out a very clear phone line. If you are in the Arctic Circle or Antarctica, wherever you are, very clear phone line. I mean, we are so grateful, and I know your audience is too, for you coming back
in. Thank you. No, I love all the love for you. I'm so thankful to you for doing both hours. I'm so thankful to Alicia and Michael Steele and everyone who helped last week. And the show is my other baby, but this week and next are about my real baby and my family. And so thank you for letting me have that time.
Well, I promise not to give any bourbon to your baby. Go back to your vacation. Thank you. Thank you endlessly for spending so much time with us. When we come back, we'll waste no time, just like they're not wasting time. Republicans are already using the Mar-a-Lago FBI search to raise money. More on that with our panel in a moment. Plus, immediately after the news broke last night, pro-Trump online forums were flooded with rage and calls for taking up arms. Some even agitating for a new civil war. A closer look at the chilling online reaction, what took place yesterday, and how the FBI search is playing into today's primaries. We're on the ground in Wisconsin as voters in that crucial battleground state are heading to the polls. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Do not, please, please, do not go anywhere.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Man, it was great to see Nicole Wallace there, or hear Nicole Wallace there. Gave us a lot to think about. In some ways, if she hadn't been on vacation, I would have been staying on for the rest of the hour and just like basically take over the show remote. But there's a lot to talk about, a lot of things she said that are worth drilling down into, and so many questions still to get to. So we're going to bring in our first panel of the 5 o'clock hour, Katie Benner, New York Times Justice Department reporter and MSNBC contributor. Also with us, MSNBC national security analyst Frank Figluzzi, former FBI assistant director for counterintelligence, and Maya Wiley, former assistant U.S. attorney, now the president of the Leadership Council on Civil and Human Rights. And Katie, I guess I want to start with you. You know, we still don't know what we don't know, and the public is eager to know more. Do you have any sense of when the public might know more?
So I think that the public will know soonest when the Trump team decides that they want to disclose the information that was given to them in the warrant, which they do have a copy of, and in the list of items that the Justice Department took from Mar-a-Lago, which they also have a copy of. So when we hear Republicans come out and say, we need to know from the Justice Department what is going on, it is actually Donald Trump who can help them. He does have all that information. For the Justice Department's part, I think that it will remain silent. It's going to hew to the playbook that is basically the standard by which the Justice Department has traditionally conducted itself, which it does not speak about ongoing investigations.
So, Frank, I want to go back to the DOJ with you because, again, you're another one of these people who I've seen on TV a lot in the last 18 hours saying really smart things all the time, which is why I wanted to have you on the show. You know, Nicole and I were just talking about the Garland kind of preplex, you know, of like a perplex of kind of what to make of him. And there's been a lot of confusion, a lot of tea leaf reading, and a lot of speculation about his mindset up until yesterday. And I'm curious about the two-part question. One, do you agree with the consensus that he would have signed off on the decision to do this search, number one? And number two, given all of your background at the FBI and as a student of Merrick Garland at this point, what do you take away from this action about what it says about the way that Garland is thinking about the issue broadly, if he's thinking about it broadly, of the prospect of indicting Donald Trump for pretty much anything?
You know, John, so first, the quick answer to your first question, almost certainly Merrick Garland would have signed off on this, not because he needs to sign off on search warrants, but because of the magnitude and gravity of this. And at very least, he would have said verbally, yes, let's go, or initialed something upon recommendation from his staff. So that's for sure. Similarly, at FBI headquarters, again, does the director need to sign off on a search warrant in Florida? No. Would he have absolutely had briefings with his staff, with his lawyers, with his counsel. I've got to tell you, I feel for the case agents on this who are you know, this the career agents working this, because they can probably do their case briefing in their sleep right now. They have briefed this probably a dozen times at various levels to various people in order to get the authorizations on this. So, yeah, absolutely. Now, Merrick Garland's been telling us for a long time who he is. We just haven't been listening, or we've been trying to overthink this. He said, I'm driven by facts and law, right? Nobody's above the law. We're going to go where the facts and the law take us. You know, Lester Holt asked him, well, what if Trump runs again? Yeah, like I said, facts and law in our own timing, right? And that's what he's doing. That's what he's doing. And I think he's letting the career people say, you know, we can't make this happen. We're done talking. It's been a year and a half of trying to get documents. And they don't have them, apparently, right? This is not, I want to emphasize, and I'm probably the 20th analyst who said this, but I'm going to say it again. This isn't about the 15 boxes they got and going, you know, maybe that was a crime. Maybe we should figure this out. No. As many have said, you've got to show that your information is fresh. When you go to that magistrate, And you say, I want to search that place because not only has a crime occurred, but there's stuff in there showing us the crime occurred, and it's still there, right? At least we think it is. And yeah, that's what the magistrate's going to say. I need to know it's still there. You got sources? You got methods? Somebody telling you it's there? Yes. So that's what this is about. And all the far right can scream and holler, but you know what they're not doing? They're not telling their viewers, their listeners, how the law works. And how a magistrate's involved, and how many layers of approval need to happen here, and what the law is. And you know what else we're not hearing from Trump and his camp is, hey, I had no classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. I had nothing here. We're not hearing that. That's important.
Maya, I actually pick up on that just because one of the things that kind of came through in one of our earlier discussions here with Andrew Weissman was just this notion that you would normally do one of two things. You'd either get these documents through a negotiation, or you'd subpoena the documents. So in order to go and ask for a search warrant, you have to be convinced that the subpoena, if issued, would not be complied with. And it raises all kinds of questions, given that Trump has and the Trump people have behaved the way they have behaved. I mean, one of them is, does one think that there's a kind of common sense fear on the part at this point, this late stage, as Frank just said, it's been going on for a long time, that the FBI and the DOJ were kind of like, if we don't go down there and do this search and get these documents we want, they're going to end up down a toilet or on fire at a fireplace.
Or in Donald Trump's mouth. You know, I mean, just to say that, you know, we've already got a series of reporting from people who said this is his behavior when he was in the White House. Why would we not believe that it's also his behavior after the White House? You know, and to Frank's point, you know, look, 15 boxes, absolutely right. It's not about the 15 boxes. But if the National Archives got 15 boxes out of Mar-a-Lago and didn't get it all, I mean, that's in and of itself pretty astounding. The Supreme Court has actually said that Donald Trump does not have any executive privilege. We heard, and I can't remember if it was Cash Patel or someone else who said, oh, he just forgot that, you know, he should declassify all these things he wanted. So we have this long pattern of behavior, which at best shows that he has been willing to do something no other president has done that we know of. And that is, as you and Nicole were discussing, wasn't sure what we were going to talk about since you all went so deep and so well. But it does go to the very central nature of national security. And as Frank said, it does have to be fresh. But we also have to say, look, you know, it's not like he hasn't been forced to give over documents already. So the fact is they should not trust or believe he will give over more because there are more. And there shouldn't be if he's doing what he's supposed to do.
Katie, I asked the question to somebody before about, you know, we're trying to parse through all this, like, what does this say about Garland, right? I want to ask, here's a factual question that isn't speculative. The White House has, in fact, been frustrated with Merrick Garland about the pace of the investigation in the 1-6 on the 1-6 matters. They have been all the way up to, according to some reports, all the way up to Joe Biden. Frustration has been ample. Suppressed largely, but ample. What is the view now? What is the Biden White House taking away from what they saw yesterday?
You know, I think there are two competing takeaways. One, which is it's hard to be upset with Merrick Garland right now for not doing enough about trying to hold the former president accountable for some of his actions. But at the same time, this comes at a time it blindsided the White House. It is policy. It is, you know, standard practice for the Justice Department not to give the White House heads up on something like this. They would want to act within the letter of the law, within their own policies to show that this was not a political act. But at the same time, it really came at a time when the White House felt that it was firing on all cylinders. It had public opinion starting to swing upward. It had attention being paid to President Biden's own policies and the moves he was making, the deals that were being cut in Congress. And now all that has been swept away. People are only paying attention right now to the words coming out of the mouths of Donald Trump and his allies about whether or not the Justice Department has acted improperly. We saw this again with the Mueller investigation earlier, where you have prosecutors who are silent because that is what they should be doing. They should be keeping silent. And Trump and his allies filling that silence with their own rhetoric, their own narrative, which then forces everybody else to respond. So all of that momentum that Biden was gaining has for now been put on pause in order to address the fact that the big story is not the current president, but the former president.
Maya, I know you got to go, so I want to get one question to you, and then we're going to bring back Frank. I have a real question for you, Frank, that I really want to get you on in a second. But Maya, I want to get you this before you go. The political element of this with Donald Trump, you know, there's a New York Times thing that makes the point. This headline, the former president said the Mar-a-Lago search was unannounced. This is what this piece in the Times says. Mr. Trump made clear in his statement that he sees potential political value in the search, something some of his advisors echoed. Depending on what any investigation produces, his political team began sending fundraising solicitations about the search late on Monday evening. You know, so political value in an FBI raid, and he said, you know, the search is unannounced. Well, we now know that's, again, shock, horror, you know, Donald Trump lying about something. But tell me what we should take away from his behavior just in having decided to announce this on his own and in trying to milk this thing in the way he clearly is.
Oh, well, he is using what he can to call out his ground troops, and that's what we're seeing. And it's dangerous for democracy, but it's good for Donald Trump. So he's seeing his opportunity to control the narrative, to say, I'm the victim, to reinforce these deep state type of conspiracies, but also suggest, frankly and indirectly, that he's above the law. And, you know, I think the opportunity here, if I was sitting on the other side of this fence, would be to utilize this to say, we didn't know, but guess what? We're delivering for the American people. What are you hearing from Republicans about what they're going to deliver to the American people? The only thing you're hearing is the fact that there's going to be retribution for doing the people's business in accordance with the law. It is absolutely an opportunity to put another foot forward. But what it says about Donald Trump is what we've always known about him, which is all about him and doesn't have anything to do with anybody else or with the rule of law or the protection of democracy or our national security. And that's what we should take from his messaging.
Maya Wiley, you've got Mouse behind you there. I love that that's deck for them. That's a good book to have on your bookshelf behind you. You, Katie Benner, thank you for spending a little time with us. Frank, you're sticking around after the break. Talks of violence and civil war erupting on far-right online channels to levels that our colleague Ben Collins says he hasn't seen since the lead-up to January 6th, and maybe really ever. He joins us next. As news broke yesterday about the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's supporters took to forums online and said a bunch of very alarming things, evoking similar memories of how those forums looked in the lead up to January 6th. According to new reporting from NBC News' Ben Collins, some were calling for violence and even civil war. From Ben's reporting, quote, users on pro-Trump forums like The Donald, a Reddit-like website that was used to provide logistics before the January 6th Capitol riot, urged immediate violence, asking questions like, quote, when does the shooting start, and calling upon Trump to summon militias. The most popular comment responding to the news, upvoted over 1,200 times, was simply the words, lock and load. Let's bring in NBC News senior reporter covering disinformation, Ben Collins, and Frankie Figgs. He's back with us. Ben, I started seeing you talking about this last night when all this stuff was happening. And you have, I have to say, your reporting is always awesome in this area. But you had this look, and you've had it for the entire time, a look of alarm, a look of being kind of unnerved by what you're seeing that I haven't seen on your face for a good many months. Talk about what your reporting is showing.
Yeah, so I think the reason the alarm is there is because it's the same guys as last time. And I'm not saying that abstractly, I'm saying that literally. The post under the post that said Lock and Load, the most popular post under that, was a guy talking about the Civil War. And that guy's name was Tyler Welsh Slaker. He is a 40-year-old man who stormed the Capitol and is awaiting sentencing for storming the Capitol. Only we knew his username, but it matches up. He also admitted it afterwards. And the reason he talked about the Civil War, he said, I'm awaiting sentencing for trespassing into the Capitol. I'm only being careful with my words. So he wanted to talk more specifically about violence, but he couldn't do it because he thought that just saying the word Civil War would somehow allow him to skate on his plea deal. So the reason I'm worried is because these people are very ready to go. They're ready to roll. They want to fight. And they've been talking for years about, you know, when do we get to start using these weapons we bought? That's the worry. They've been waiting for an inciting event and having their guy taken down by the feds. If that happens in the future, to them, that suffices.
You know, the other thing you write about, and I'll read a little bit of this here, is about the notion of the rhetoric on the in these crazy far-right forums moving into the mainstream. And you say more mainstream pro-Trump influencers, including podcasters with millions of followers on YouTube or Twitter, have also heightened their rhetoric. Tomorrow is war. Stephen Crowder, who has over 5 million subscribers on YouTube and 1 million followers on Twitter, said in a tweet, quote, sleep well. I don't think I may ever sleep again. You know, that's another whole problem, right? The mainstreaming of this. And there's the fact that so much of it seems, whether it's Donald Trump himself or people who are allied with Donald Trump, they seem to be doing this intentionally. They're stirring these people up. Talk about all of that.
Yeah, the Steven Crowders of the world are not going to be on the front line of the Civil War, right? Those people, they're just not going to be there. But they would love to rile people up enough to sell the prepper goods and, you know, the koozies and stuff, the Civil War merchandise that they desperately want to sell and have been selling for years. You know, Alex Jones has been selling prepper kits and stuff about the end of the world, the apocalypse, Civil War for literally a decade now, maybe a couple of decades now. So a lot of these people, it's a profit opportunity, but it's also a political opportunity. You saw that CPAC last weekend. They view January 6th prisoners, as they call them, as martyrs. And, you know, they view them to be unjustly held, despite the fact that they don't believe it was them. They believe it was Antifa or something. It's all very mixed messaging. That's the point. The point is to confuse you. As Steve Bannon once said, I don't want to actually say it on TV now that I think about it.
Let's not say that on TV.
Yeah, let's not say it on TV. But the point is to confuse people in these moments and to rile them up. And that's stochastic terror. That's how you get people upset enough to do the dirty work for you.
Right. It's flood the system with stuff. And yep. Frank, I'm going to ask you two questions, Frank. One's quick, just because I really want to get to the second one, which I didn't get to in the last block. The first one is this. Are you as worried as he is? Like, with what you're seeing right now, this is one of your things you focus on is militias and the far right and extremists. Are you right now, whether you're doing that level of reporting that Ben's doing or not, are you like kind of going, man, this is bad?
Yeah, because while Ben's got me on this, the depth and breadth of what he sees and where he looks, and it's more places than I likely look, I know what the capabilities of the FBI and federal law enforcement are. And so I am worried because they cannot be everywhere at all times. They cannot see everything at all times. So yes, indeed, I am very concerned about the security environment moving forward for the next several months.
So here's the question I didn't get to last time that I want to know about from you, which is a really nuts and bolts question about the investigation the FBI did when they got down to Mar-a-Lago, right? So they're hunting around in there. They had the search warrant. They are only allowed to go certain places that would be the kinds of places that what they're looking for might be. You know, Joyce Vance gave the example. You can't look at a safe if you're looking for an elephant or something, right? So they're looking in those places. Let's say they look at Donald Trump's safe, as he said they did. What if they come across evidence of another crime? if they come across something that's January 6th related, something related to the January 6th crime, say they came across a handwritten note from Vladimir Putin that that clearly indicated bribery or something else untoward. What happens there?
So it's a plain view doctrine, and they're certainly allowed to take what is in plain view. They're lawfully there. They're executing a lawful search warrant. This happens, by the way, all the time with regard to drugs, right? You go in for X, you look around, you go, oh, that's heroin over there. We've got to do something about that. Similarly here, but I want to attach a caveat to that, which is we're getting, unfortunately, the only description we're getting of what happened in there is from the Trump camp and Trump lawyers who say they seem to be grabbing up everything or they didn't use discretion or something like that. Okay. That tells me, if that's even half accurate, they might have just been grabbing anything that looked like it was classified or fit whatever they were led to believe, maybe from a source, maybe not, was in a certain place, you know, at a certain time, and grab that and grab this, and we'll look at it later. We'll look at it later. So I don't know. I'm not getting the impression. While they say they were there for a few hours, I'm not sure they spent a huge amount of time looking through things and saying, this looks like a bribe from Vladimir Putin. But yes, to answer your question, they absolutely, based on the plain view doctrine, well settled in the law, they could have grabbed evidence of other crimes.
Right. They're looking for stuff in a minute. The documents they're looking for are said to be in manila folders. They grab all the manila folders, and if there's evidence of other crimes in those manila folders, that's all admissible. Yeah?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
God, let us pray. All right. Ben Collins, Frank Figliuzzi, thank you. Up next, less than 24 hours after the FBI search of the former president's South Florida home, voters are taking to the polls in a key battleground state, how the candidates are responding, and will this impact voters' decisions? A live report from Wisconsin, the Badger State, coming up next. Stick around.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
It's scary to wake up this morning and see that the government has raided the house of the former president. If they can do it to the former president, they can do it to anybody, and that is very concerning. What can you do about it today? Today you can go vote and let your voice be heard. That's what elections are all about.
I found it shocking, unprecedented. I remain shocked by what I saw and what I'm hearing. I sure hope that the president and his family are okay.
Two candidates, both vying for the Republican nomination for governor of the state of Wisconsin as they cast their ballots in today's primary election. It's a state that was key to Joe Biden's victory in 2020 and looms very large in 2024. The candidates up there falling all over themselves to defend the former president just hours after the FBI search at Mar-a-Lago. The two have divided the Republican Party in the Badger State, with Tim Michaels receiving Donald Trump's endorsement and former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish endorsed by the former Vice President Mike Pence and former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Joining us now, NBC News correspondent Shaq Brewster, live from Waukesha, Wisconsin. I love Waukesha. And Sam Stein, Politico's White House editor, as well as an MSNBC contributor. People say that all the time. Shaq, you know, it's like one of the bellwether counties in all of American politics. What's the view from Waukesha on the Republican fight for governor in this primary today?
Yeah, I think when I've been talking to voters as they've been coming out of the polling booth behind me, you get a sense of how close both candidates and campaigns expect this race to be. It's like they're alternating. Some say that they're going with Tim Michaels, the Trump-backed candidate, as you mentioned, who initially wasn't even registering in the polls, wasn't even included in the Marquette University poll. But after that endorsement and after funding this campaign and putting spending millions of dollars to get his name out on the airwaves, shot up to the top of the polls. And then you have other people coming out saying that they're backing the former lieutenant governor, saying that she's familiar to them and that they trust the endorsement of Vice President Pence and that key endorsement from her former boss in Scott Walker. So you really get a sense that this is going to be down to the wire. This, the endorsements that you saw in this race, voters telling me that's something that they were paying close attention to. And you were mentioning the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. I'll tell you, I've asked each and every voter that I talked to coming out of the polls. I've asked them about that. Yes, many of them are aware of it. They have their own personal opinions on it, but all of them told me that it didn't matter. It didn't control or impact the vote that they made and that decision that they made inside the voting booth. So one thing that we're also watching is what turnout will be. You heard Michaels there try to drive up turnout in this GOP primary. It will wait to see those final numbers, but I think the big thing that you're expecting is this will be a tight race as we wait for those results.
Shaq, I say real quick here, when you talk to voters there, how many of them walking out of the polling place when you ask them about what they think about the governor's race, how many actually just of their own volition invoke Donald Trump or invoke Mike Pence?
You have a few of them doing it. When I say, what is it? They might not say it's because of Donald Trump, but what you hear them say is it's because I trust him on election integrity. And that's something that when former President Trump was here in Waukesha last week, you heard him really tout. And that was part of the reason why he's backing Tim Michaels. You might hear when they mention Clayfish, they might say that I trust her and I remember her from the Act 10 days. So it's not, it might not be a direct reference to Trump or Scott Walker, but there's a reference that you hear there.
Sam, you don't have a lot of time here, but I got to say, we got these primaries in Wisconsin, yeah. Connecticut, Minnesota, Vermont. You know everything about American politics at all times. What are you watch? What are you watching tonight other than the Wisconsin gubernatorial primary?
Well, it's the fissures along the lines in the Republican Party that's key here, right? We've seen a few cases where the Trump endorsement really did matter materially to pulling over a candidate. And, you know, Wisconsin is going to be another litmus test of that. I'm actually looking at Robin Voss in Wisconsin because he, the powerful Wisconsin Assembly Speaker, you know, he's been targeted by Trump despite going to great lengths to help him out. What happens in that race? What kind of vote total he gets? That's going to be top of mind. But again, it's that fissure in Republican politics, whether the Trump candidate emerges over the more established one, that really is the story of the cycle so far.
Shaq Brewster, Sam Stein, would love to have spent more time with you, but there was this other news we had to deal with. But thanks for coming on, and thanks for being with us on this Tuesday, this historic, momentous Tuesday.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.